Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Voiko vanhemmuuteen valmistautua? Mikä vauvakuplassa on totta ja mikä ei? Liberon odotushuone-podcastissa tehdään todellinen syväsukellus vanhemmuuden tiekarttaan. Minä olen Marja Hintikka ja tämä vanhemmuuden odotushuoneen ovi on aina auki, just sulle.
People Fixing the World is the podcast looking for solutions to the problems we face today.
It could potentially ease the suffering of millions.
We have a solution. Let's do it.
People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 2nd of April, these are our main stories. A senior Iranian Revolutionary Guard commander is among at least seven people killed in a suspected Israeli airstrike on a building in the Syrian capital. Our international editor Jeremy Bowen gives us his assessment.
I think they've seen the way that both Iran and Hezbollah have been pretty cautious. They do not want to escalate this to an all-out war. So perhaps the Israelis are thinking, well, that gives us a bit more latitude to push.
The Kremlin rejects a media report linking Russian agents to a mystery illness that's affected US diplomats. And widespread anger in Ghana after a 63-year-old traditional priest marries a 12-year-old girl. Also in this podcast, the Harry Potter novelist J.K. Rowling challenges Scotland's new hate crime law, inviting police to arrest her if they think she's committed an offence. And why have mindfulness when you could have this Dutch trend?
Nixon is a verb that comes from the noun nix, which translates to nothing in English. So it's the art of being effortlessly aimless.
Iran has promised a decisive response after one of its consulate buildings was destroyed by a suspected Israeli airstrike in the Syrian capital, Damascus. Hossein Akbari is the Iranian ambassador to Syria.
Definitely the Zionist regime knows better than anyone that such crimes and violating international law will have its response at the appropriate time.
The country's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps says seven of its members died in the strike, including a senior commander. Israel has carried out many strikes on Iranian-linked targets in Syria in the past few years, but rarely acknowledges them. There are fears this attack could inflame regional tensions. In the aftermath, Syria's Foreign Minister Faisal Mekdad pledged his support for the Palestinians.
Our people have grown used to responding to such cowardly attacks. These attacks can only be met with further steadfastness and further support for the Palestinian people and the resistance, whether in Iraq or southern Lebanon.
Our international editor Jeremy Bowen, who's in northern Israel, told me more.
There's been a big airstrike. It's flattened the building next to the Iranian embassy, which is in Mezeh, which is a rich part of the central part of Damascus. It seems to have been the consulate building that has been destroyed. And with it, General Mohammad Reza Zahedi. He's the target because he is the most important Iranian general in Syria and in Lebanon, two vital areas for them.
Do we have any evidence at this point as to who was behind what happened today?
This is a precision strike on the man who would live behind a lot of security, who would try and keep his movements secret. So whoever hit him, I think we have to assume it's Israel, they had the intelligence, they knew where he was, the capacity to level the building. The buildings around it weren't particularly damaged, so it was a very much a precision strike. So I think what's happened is that the Israelis, I'm guessing now, but I'm sure they have been trying to get this man, and they have decided that they had an opportunity. They've done it, and they have assassinated other high-level people in Hezbollah, for example, in Hamas in Lebanon, in the month since October the 7th. But this is the most senior target they've managed to hit and kill thus far.
And the big question now is what the Iranian response will be.
Yeah, it is. Again, it's all speculative. I think there have been reports out of Tehran saying that they will respond. But 2020, the very, very senior Iranian general Qasem Soleimani was assassinated by the Americans in Baghdad, alongside a militia leader in Iraq, you know, two very significant targets. And there were not the sort of immediate, full-on retaliations you'd expect. I've been talking to people today who are suggesting, well, maybe if they retaliate, it could be through some sort of a cyber attack. Hezbollah in Lebanon, and I'm talking to you from northern Israel, not very far from the Lebanese border, they have a lot of capacity, much of it provided by Iran, to launch missiles into Israel. And they've been doing that on a regular basis. It's a very significant escalation. There was one today and one, I think, last week. There have been drone attacks out of Iraq that have hit the southern Israeli port on the Red Sea of Eilat. This is an important leader on the Iranian side, and they've decided to do it. And I think they're also challenging the deterrence, if you like, that Iran has been trying to build up, because I think they've seen in the last few months the way that both Iran and Hezbollah have been pretty cautious. They do not want to escalate this to an all-out war. So perhaps the Israelis are thinking, well, that gives us a bit more latitude to push. And that's certainly what they've done now.
Our international editor, Jeremy Bowen. Meanwhile, in Gaza, Palestinians have described graphic scenes of death and destruction at the territory's biggest hospital, Al-Shifa, after Israeli forces withdrew from a two-week raid targeting Hamas fighters who were alleged to have returned to the site. The Hamas-run health ministry in Gaza says dozens of bodies have been recovered. The White House said it would demand more information from Israel. Here's White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre.
Hamas has intentionally embedded themselves into these hospitals. And so we've been very clear as it relates to the footage, as it relates to the photos and reportings. We have not verified that footage. We're reaching out to the Israeli government to get more information. But obviously, if these reports are true, that is indeed deeply concerning.
Our correspondent Hugo Bashega has more from Jerusalem.
At Gaza City's Al-Shifa Hospital, a scene of complete desolation. Walls scorched by fire and pounded by explosions, with rooms and wards reduced to rubble. For 2 weeks, this was the scene of an Israeli incursion against what the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, described as a terrorist lair. Today, Israeli troops pulled out, leaving a wasteland of destroyed buildings and dozens of Palestinian bodies in and around the complex. Mutassem Dalou, a local journalist, was one of the hundreds of people who went to see the damage.
I saw all the buildings of Al-Shifa Hospital completely or partially destroyed. People screaming, crying. They are looking for their loved ones. I saw mass graves, bodies scattered every side of the destroyed buildings.
The Israeli army said it had killed 200 people who it described as terrorists and that 500 suspected fighters were detained. Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner is a spokesperson for the Israeli military.
Hundreds of Hamas terrorists had taken up positions utilizing the premises, different wards, different buildings to conduct command and control capabilities, communicate with the forces in the north of the Gaza Strip, and effectively had created a northern fortress within the Gaza Strip within the premises of the Shifa compound.
Hamas called the destruction of the complex a crime against humanity. For critics of the Israeli campaign in Gaza, this shows not only that Palestinian fighters still have the ability to regroup, it also demonstrates a lack of a long-term plan by the Israeli military, as not long after its forces left the hospital last year, enemy fighters went back.
A new investigation has accused Russia of being behind Havana syndrome, a mystery illness which has affected American diplomats stationed in many countries. The joint report by Der Spiegel, The Insider and CBS's 60 Minutes says a Russian military intelligence unit may have been involved. Moscow has denied the accusations. Rachel Wright has the story.
Havana syndrome was first identified in Cuba's capital city in 2016 when US diplomats began to complain of dizziness, headaches and a painful sound in the ears. More than 1,000 reports of the condition have been made since, and people with confirmed brain injuries from the illness are eligible for compensation from the US government. US intelligence had suggested that those affected could have been hit by microwaves from hidden devices, but said it was unlikely a foreign power was to blame. Now, evidence has emerged suggesting that operatives from a Russian military intelligence unit may have targeted US diplomats with direct energy weapons. The report said the evidence placed members of the unit in cities around the world at times when American personnel who were stationed there reported feeling unwell. One victim, an FBI agent, told CBS 60 Minutes she felt like she'd been hit by a powerful force when she fell ill in 2021.
Inside my right ear, it was like a dentist drilling on steroids, and it knocked me forward. and pressure and pain started coursing from inside my right ear, down my jaw, down my neck, and into my chest.
The woman, known as Carrie, said she passed out and later had issues with memory and concentration. The Kremlin has dismissed the accusations as baseless and unfounded.
India is bracing itself for more heat waves than normal between now and June. This means temperatures are expected to reach more than 40 degrees, or at least 4.5 degrees higher than average. It also says they'll last longer than normal, making it the third year in a row of excessive heat in India and coming as the country prepares for a general election. Our Southeast Asia regional editor Anbarasan Ethirajan is in Delhi.
The Met Office has been warning that the number of days where they expect the heat wave to persist has increased up to 10 to 20 days instead of 4 to 8 days. So that is having a huge impact on a number of sectors across the country. First of all, you have the mammoth election coming up starting from the 19th of April, where tens of thousands of people will attend rallies. So that is a big concern because in one of the meetings last year near Mumbai, 12 people died of heat stroke and then hundreds got admitted.
It's not unusual for there to be very hot days in Delhi, but we're talking about many hot days this month, next month, the month after that.
These 3 months are going to be really hot. I mean, usually summer is hot in India, but what the scientists are saying is that the intensity of the heat has increased, not just about Delhi. If you see the major cities, some of the areas were witnessing 5 degrees Celsius more than what it used to be. Day wage laborers, those who are involved in construction work, that will have health issues for them, so they have to stop work at some point. And also agricultural laborers who are working in the field and people pulling carts or rickshaws. That's a huge social problem. If the heat persists, that will have an impact on agricultural production as well. India is the world's second biggest producer of wheat. In 2022, because of this heat wave, it hit the overall production. And as a result, India banned exports for a few months. It is not simply about people trying to protect themselves from the heat wave, it is also having an impact on society and agriculture as well as business.
A lot of people will be thinking, is this more evidence of global warming? Is that something that's being talked about?
People do realize that the temperatures have gone up now. Scientific studies show that 0.15 degrees increasing over the years every year. Scientists are clearly linking this with both global warming as well as with the El Nino weather pattern, where the intensity of the heat as well as the intensity of the monsoon both increase.
Anbarasan Ethirajan with me from India. Easter celebrations have been taking place across the globe over the weekend, but in Iran, anyone seen marking Christian traditions is arrested. For that reason, Christians are turning their homes and even their cars into makeshift churches so they can worship without being detected by the authorities. The BBC's Sara Manetta has been talking to some celebrating Easter in secret.
Tina is cooking dinner for her husband and young children. On a table in a corner of the living room, she has made a display with tea lights, pastel-coloured eggs, and a little wooden cross. It's her own intimate way to mark Easter. She and her husband converted to Christianity years ago, and because of that, they could be arrested. So I'm not using her real name, and her words are being voiced by an actress.
It is very difficult knowing that our beliefs could lead to our imprisonment, particularly for someone like me who has children.
In Iran, some minorities like Armenian and Assyrian Christians are allowed to practice their religion, but they are banned from preaching to other Iranians or even letting them into their churches. So people like Tina can only practice their faith in secret, in so-called house churches.
We meet in small groups and each time in different places. It could be in the home of one of our members or sometimes even in a park or in a car while driving. It is safer if each group knows as little as possible about the others. So if one group encounters problems, the rest aren't implicated. On special days like Christmas and Easter, the government also intensifies its efforts to identify and arrest people. So we've never been able to celebrate Christmas or Easter on the actual day. So we have to shift the timing and do it a few weeks later.
Tina and her husband have received warnings but have not been arrested so far. Many others have not been so lucky.
One day there was a knock on the door and there was like 10 officers standing in front of the door.
Mehdi was 20 the first time he was arrested. Due to safety concerns, again, I'm not using his real name. He says he was kept in solitary confinement, interrogated repeatedly and threatened. But it was the second time he was arrested, when he was 24, that really left a mark on him.
This time I was in solitary confinement for more than a month, and the interrogations were more intense. They kept us in there for 3 years.
When he was released, he couldn't go back to his old life. Eventually, he decided to flee Iran. According to the NGO Article 18, at least 166 Christians were arrested in Iran last year. Authorities led a spate of arrests in the months leading up to the anniversary of the death of Mahsa Amini, the young woman who died while in custody of the Iranian morality police, who had accused her of not wearing her headscarf properly. Mansour Borji, the founder and director of Article 18, believes that the increased pressure by Iranian authorities on protesters and religious minorities is backfiring.
They have alienated the younger generation.
Back in her home, Tina and a few other members of her church are planning a postponed Easter celebration.
We have to take precautions because we know the government has plans for those days as well.
Now, you may have been marking Easter over the last couple of days or taking the opportunity to do something active. Perhaps you've been doing nothing. There is a Dutch word for that, niksen. Our correspondent Anna Holligan told Nick Robinson more.
If you think about mindfulness, that has the explicit goal of being fully present in the moment, whereas niksen is about letting yourself just be idle without trying to be productive. It's mindlessness. And niksen is a verb that comes from the noun niks, which translates to nothing in English. So niksen is to nothing. It's the art of being effortlessly aimless. And we tend to feel guilty about doing nothing, but the Dutch are pragmatic people, and as far as they're concerned, you have to own that nothingness, and they've given it this name, niksen, to do nothing without a purpose.
So what are you meant to gain?
Well, if you look at some of the data, the Dutch have one of the shortest working weeks in Europe, yet they're among the most productive people, constantly rate as one of the world's happiest nations. They prioritise work-life balance. It's perfectly plausible that niksen could be part of the secret to that success. And there is a science behind niksen. So by building relaxing moments or brain breaks into your days, you can balance your stress levels by tapping into your rest and digest response. So a few minutes of niksen every day could improve your focus and decision making. It's all about your frontal lobe, the section of the brain involved in decision making and self-control. That becomes increasingly tired the more cognitive load you put on it. So when you rest, your frontal lobe powers down and lets your default mode take over. So if you think about those moments when you're actually not trying to achieve anything, that's when your greatness can really take over. We're told to chill, but then we feel guilty about doing nothing. So niksen, it's about giving yourself permission, recognizing the value and simply tuning in and zoning out.
Our correspondent Anna Holligan with Nick Robinson. Still to come on the Global News podcast, Hollywood actresses and close friends Anne Hathaway and Jessica Chastain on their new film, Mother's Instinct.
I love Annie. It actually sometimes makes it more difficult to play friends who then have a conflict. But I think what it does is it gives the film an edge.
There's been widespread anger in Ghana after a 63-year-old traditional priest got married to a girl of 12. The customary wedding ceremony took place outside the capital Accra on Saturday. Our Africa regional editor Richard Hamilton reports.
The legal age for marriage in Ghana is 18, and the prevalence of child brides has declined, but the practice still continues. Videos of this event have been widely shared on social media. During the ceremony, women told the girl to dress teasingly and use perfume to increase her sexual appeal to her husband. These remarks have been perceived to mean that the marriage was not merely ceremonial. Ghanaian law recognises customary unions, but does not allow child marriages under the guise of culture or tradition.
Next to South Korea, and a story about spy cameras, elections and a YouTube influencer. Police are searching for two men who've been accused of helping a YouTuber to install dozens of spy cameras at polling stations ahead of local elections on Thursday. Our Asia Pacific regional editor Celia Hatton told me more.
A few days ago, police arrested a YouTuber who had been going online and spouting unfounded theories that there had been manipulation in the South Korean elections. They then went on police to reveal that they'd found quite a few illegal secret cameras in polling and vote counting stations that had been set up for early voting in the parliamentary elections. The number of illegal cameras that's been found has now risen to 40 devices that were disguised to look like electrical chargers that had been plugged into a wall outlet. They even had stickers of South Korean telecommunications companies stuck onto them to make them look authentic. But they were actually cameras this YouTuber was going to use to try to watch the voting process. They've actually issued two more arrest warrants for two other men they believe were helping to install these secret spy cameras all over South Korea.
What I'm intrigued by is, what use would it be to be able to film how people have voted?
Well, this suspect, as he was paraded by the police, said that he had wanted to check the numbers of early voters. It doesn't have a basis and it has been unfounded, but he has a theory that there is a difference between the people who vote in early elections and the people who vote in the main voting period. So that's what he wanted to use this spy camera footage for. Amazingly, police have actually said that they actually found a spy camera that they believe was installed by this same person during the 2023 by-election in Seoul, where they'd also found spy cameras installed at the early voting stations.
Is this a one-off, or is it common to have different sorts of election interference in South Korea?
South Korea really is seen as quite a healthy democracy with transparent elections that are quite free and fair, very close monitoring by the media. But this YouTuber represents fears that South Korean politics is becoming more polarized. And also, the authorities have said they are worried about other things, including artificial intelligence, the threat of deepfakes. And so there are concerns for the wider health of South Korean elections. But I think that that's something that politicians in many democracies are becoming concerned about.
Our Asia Pacific editor Celia Hatton with me. The author of the world famous Harry Potter novels, J.K. Rowling, has invited police to arrest her if they think she's committed an offence under a new hate crime law that's just come into force in Scotland. Ms. Rowling, who lives in the capital, Edinburgh, says the legislation is a threat to free speech. Here's our Scotland editor, James Cook.
The Hate Crime and Public Order Act criminalises behaviour which crosses a line from offensive, shocking or disturbing to threatening and abusive. It deals with offences aggravated by prejudice and creates a crime of stirring up hatred relating to age, disability, religion, sexual orientation, transgender identity or being intersex. Stirring up racial hatred was and remains illegal. But one group is not protected by the law: women. J.K. Rowling says that is wrong. On social media today, the author posted about several trans people who are protected, adding that she looked forward to being arrested if what she had written about them qualified as an offence. Earlier, Susan Smith of the gender critical campaign group For Women Scotland had predicted a flood of complaints.
There will be a rush to report people to the police. I imagine that there will be many complaints, for example, made against J.K. Rowling. So there is a high chance the police will be overwhelmed with a lot of complaints, some of which will be purely spurious.
Scotland's First Minister, Hamza Youssef, says the threshold for criminality in the new law is incredibly high, but insists it is needed.
We have seen, I'm afraid, right across many parts of the world, it's kind of rising tide of hatred against people because of their protected characteristics. So unless your behaviour is threatening or abusive and intends to stir up hatred, then you have nothing to worry about in terms of the new offences being created.
Mr. Youssef's government is planning a separate law to tackle hatred and harassment of women. But for now, senior police officers are worried about the impact of this act, with the complaints already coming in.
China's leaders are trying to find ways to tackle what's been described as a demographic ticking time bomb. It's simultaneously ageing and shrinking population. One in five people are over the age of 60, which is the largest elderly population in the world. Pension and healthcare systems are struggling to cope at a time when women are having fewer babies. So can the world's second largest economy afford to grow old? Our China correspondent Laura Bicker has been investigating.
At the back of morning exercise class, Grandma Fen and her friends are giggling and gossiping. They live together in one of China's flagship elderly care homes in the south of the country. She's decided to pay for long-term care rather than rely on her son.
I'm more open-minded. There are few people of the same age who think like us. I give my house to my son. All we need is our two pension cards.
In the community room, there are young people being beaten at table tennis by 80-year-olds. They live here rent-free and volunteer to care for the elderly. The home is partly funded by private companies, so that could help out local governments who are deep in debt. But after the pandemic, the home is currently running at a loss, so Beijing does need other ideas. On the sunny banks of the Grand Canal in Hangzhou, we meet four women, all over 55. They're a new kind of social media star, promoting greying gracefully. China hopes more over 60s will continue working as the economy slows. So we've come to the north of China, to Liaoning province. The reason we've come here is because it has the highest percentage of elderly in the whole of China. Former digger operator Tang Guohe looks after six residents. She grows all her own crops. The animals, too, are dinner. She's tapping into the need to find solutions for the large elderly population in this province.
It's really tough without a pension in rural areas. Just see that 85-year-old man. He doesn't have a pension. His son pays 1 month, his daughter pays next month. But they need to live, too. Now I have to pay my pension every month, even if I don't eat or drink.
But for some, retirement will never be an option. In a village nearby, we find farmer Han Xiao Sao and his wife.
Do you have a pension?
No, I don't have a pension. I guess I will become a burden for my children. I'm 72 this year. I think I can only keep doing this for another 4 or 5 years. But if feeble and weak, then I might be confined to bed. That's it. Over. Ordinary people like us all end up like this.
Like much of rural China, there are very few young people left here to look after the old, especially after decades of a policy allowing couples to only have one child. The rising ranks of the elderly are causing a dramatic imbalance, which means China may grow old before it gets rich.
Laura Bicker reporting. The newly released film Mother's Instinct stars the American actors Anne Hathaway and Jessica Chastain in the role of best friends who seem to have it all as they raise sons of the same age in the same neighbourhood. The psychological thriller follows their apparently picture-perfect life in 60s American suburbia. Here's a scene where Alice and Celine are searching for their boys, Max and Theo. The latter happens to have a severe nut allergy.
Theo? Alice? What's going on? The boys have Max's cookies.
Okay. Well, Theo knows he can't have one.
He's seven. He dreams of trying them.
Theo! Ah! No more cake for them.
Well, over here.
What's that?
A secret tunnel.
Where are the cookies?
Just back there.
Did you eat any?
Dirty.
No.
When I call you, you answer me, okay? Okay? Theo, say yes, Mom, okay?
Yes, Mom.
Okay.
Jessica and Anne told Nuala McGovern what it was like playing best friends who begin to be suspicious of each other and then start questioning the relationship.
I love Annie. I think she's such an incredible artist and person. And it actually sometimes makes it more difficult to play friends who then have a conflict develop, especially when you care about the person so much. But I think what it does is it gives the film an edge.
It does have
an edge. And I've lost my voice for everyone.
I was just thinking it was very husky. But you play Alice. How would you describe her character? And I'd have to say, oh my goodness, the glamour and the fashion and the style of this film, as well as its substance. But let's talk about Alice, Jessica.
Oh, thank you, Mitchell Travers, who's our costume designer, for beautiful looks for the characters. And it takes place in the 1960s, so I think that adds to the element of glamour in it. Alice, I mean, she's really a product of that time. She really wants a career. She loves being a mom, but she feels that there's a part of her that is held down. Both these characters, they're being repressed in some way, which creates the tsunami of emotions that come out.
Celine, Anne, tell us about her.
Jessica just said it really, really well. I think both of these women are being repressed. And I think Celine has a very delicate equation going on inside of her. And she just thinks, technically, I got so much of what I wanted, so I'm not going to think about the ways that it happened. And she uses a word that I think people are becoming more familiar with. She's very unhealed. She has a very happy layer on top of a lot of turmoil. And so when that top layer is removed and you actually see the pain that she's been living with and what it makes her do, how it makes her treat the people around her, how it makes her treat herself, it should be shocking. But when you consider a society that doesn't allow a full expression of oneself based on arbitrary factors like gender, maybe it isn't that shocking.
Gosh, when you talk about layers, I'm thinking of one point when you have a black lace mantilla over your face. And I'm trying to see in your eyes what it is that you're trying to get across. It's called Mother's Instinct. Controversial term, maternal instinct. Lots of debates about that. Do you believe in it, Jessica?
Absolutely. The most dangerous animal that you come across in the wild is a mother with her cubs and her children. So absolutely, I believe in a mother's instinct.
Yes, I've experienced it many times where you sort of go from like pleasant to beast very fast. So yeah, I do believe in instincts.
Do you think it's different to paternal instinct?
Well, maybe we could just say parental instincts. Mm-hmm. I think an extreme instinct towards a protective love. Maybe we could just put it that way.
And it's not just actors, of course. You're both listed as producers on this film. And Jessica, your female-led production company, Freckle Film. Is it getting easier to get the things made that you want to get made as a woman? Anne, what do you think?
Well, the part that my ear pricked to in that sentence was the things that you want to get made. And I think that it's a whole process, not just figuring out how you get things made, but what it is you want to see out there and why. I think that there are certain numbers that are showing us that, yeah, progress is being made. There's also statistics that show it's not happening quickly enough and it's not happening enough for everyone in the same way. But I do see more inclusivity in terms of storytelling. I think you just need to look at the Best Picture nominees this year at the Oscars. Yeah. And there's a much wider variety of stories being told than 10 years ago. There's a phrase that I really love. It's a Creole phrase and it's petit à petit, l'oiseau fait son nid. And it means little by little, the bird builds its nest. And I sort of feel like that's what we're all doing. We're all contributing to it little by little. And hopefully inside of a generation, they won't really know what it is that we're going on about.
I do see a difference when I started in the industry about 12 years ago, in terms of stories about, as Annie says, not just gender, but there's just more variety in storytelling. And so we're not coming from one demographic over and over again. And I see a difference in terms of more actresses producing, which is really inspiring to me because those are the markers that young girls notice and then they realize it's possible. And so, yes, little by little, we're making our nest.
Jessica Chastain and Anne Hathaway with Nuala McGovern. And that's all from us for now. There'll be a new edition of Global News to download later. This edition was mixed by Darcy O'Bree. The producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
People fixing the world.
Brilliant solutions to the world's problems.
All right, let's do this.
We meet people with ideas to make the world a better place.
Trying new things that they're really passionate about.
And investigate whether they work.
The idea is you send in a robot where it's unsafe to send another human being.
Wow, okay.
People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service.
Buckle up and get ready to ride.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.